Disrupting. Disruption.
Hi there, Whitney here. I am delighted to share another bonus episode with you this week. This is my conversation with author and organizational psychologist, Adam Grant. Episode 119 from July 2019. I loved learning about Adam's formative experiences, but most importantly, pay close attention to his framework around give and take. In his book by the same title, he identifies three categories of people: givers, takers, and those who match or reciprocate. Which category do you fall into? Which category has the most successful people? The answer is complicated. Don't confuse takers with those willing to receive help. And even if you're not a giver at heart, Adam's advice about being a mini helper can go a long way. Even if you've heard this episode before, it might be worth revisiting with fresh ears. Adam Grant, welcome to the Disrupt Yourself podcast.
Thanks, Whitney.
First question for you is, where did you grow up and what did you want to be when you grew up?
I grew up in the Detroit suburbs, and I hated the question of what I wanted to be when I grew up because, you know, first of all, I had all these unrealistic aspirations. I wanted to be a professional basketball player, but, you know, when you start high school at 4'9" and end up 5'9", not that likely. And then, you know, after I got over some of those pipe dreams, I realized I didn't want to be one thing. I wanted to do many things. And the idea of, you know, having to take on one career as my sole identity and, you know, kind of get stuck in that, you know, in that one box was incredibly limiting. And so I was really undecided until the right before I started my senior year of college. I had no clue what I wanted to be, let alone do.
All the way until your senior year of college, you didn't know what you wanted to do.
I was completely lost when it came to career.
And so you didn't like the question in part because you didn't have an answer to it, but also because you felt like it was restrictive to your identity. Is that what was happening?
Yeah, I wanted to be more than just a job or just a career field. And I also didn't want to have to lock in to one path as who I was going to become. I felt like I had many different interests. I was, you know, starting to develop different kinds of skills, and I wanted to get to combine them in all sorts of interesting ways as opposed to say, okay, I'm going to go down a path and I'm stuck on it.
What were some of the interests that you had in college? I suspect there were two or three things that were all kind of tickling your brain. What were some of those things?
Yeah. So going into college, probably my two strongest passions were diving, springboard diving, and magic. And, you know, not very practical careers in either case, right? I did actually, when people would ask me when I was going from high school to college, what I wanted to do for a career, I told them my dream was to be a diving coach because it was the thing that I loved doing most. And I had an incredible coach, Eric Best, who really fundamentally changed my life. And I wanted to try to pay that forward as much as I could. And, you know, magic I loved because it was really fun to, you know, to watch a trick, see if I could figure out a way to do it, and then surprise and delight audiences. And I felt like, okay, you know, I'm probably not going to be a professional magician ever. And that means I have no idea what to do from here.
Interesting. Okay, let's go to the diving. I want to come back to the magic later, but for right now, let's talk about diving. So reading Give and Take, I learned that you started diving when you were in high school. Tell us about that. How did that happen?
Well, so actually right before I started high school, it was the summer and I guess I was playing video games, you know, 10 or 11 hours a day. And my mom decided that she was going to drag me out into the sunlight and she took me to go swimming at a local pool. And there was a lifeguard there who was not a regular guard. He was subbing for someone. So total serendipity. On one of his breaks, he gets up on the diving board and starts to do all these mesmerizing flips and twists. And I guess I'd seen diving on TV in the Olympics, but there's something different about seeing it up close. And I just thought it was extraordinary. And I said, I want to learn how to do that. The athleticism, the control, you know, the ability to jump high and spin fast and then, you know, land precisely without a splash in the water, just kind of disappear. I said, I have to learn how to do that. I started taking classes that summer and then You know, when high school rolled around, I showed up for the very first day of the swimming and diving team. I guess it was a tryout. And I don't think I've ever been so focused, at least up until that point in my life. I had never been so determined to, you know, to achieve something as I was to make that freshman year diving team. And afterward, Eric said, "Do you want the good news or the bad news?" And, you know, here I'm looking at this brilliant coach and saying, "Oh gosh, what's, you know, tell me, there's bad news. I want to know right away." And he says, "Well, diving requires three things. It requires flexibility, explosive power, and grace." And he says, "You know, to be perfectly honest, you can't touch your toes without bending your knees. My grandmother can jump higher than you. And you walk like Frankenstein." But he's laughing as he says this. I'm like, "What's the good news?" And he goes on to tell me that diving is sort of a nerd sport, that it attracts all the people who were, you know, too short for basketball, too weak for football, too slow for track. And so if I work really hard at this sport, he believes I can be a state finalist by my senior year. And that he will, no matter, he doesn't care how good I am, that whatever level of effort I put in, he's willing to put in that level of effort as a coach too.
Wow.
Yeah. He actually said, "I will never cut a diver who wants to be here." And I mean, to me, that is the epitome of what a coach is, right? To say, "Look, you know, I respond to your motivation, not what I think is your talent level."
Okay. So you won the lottery when it came to coaches, basically.
Oh, I did. I mean, I have never met a better coach. And I think, you know, I worked with lots of diving coaches over the years. And, you know, now I've had the chance to work with coaches of professional sports teams and world-class executive coaches. And Eric is still the best coach I've ever met.
Wow. What a gift. Can you think of a moment where you had a dive and it was just the most splendid dive? What was the dive? Where were you? What happened?
Well, I can think of lots of moments where I thought that until I came out of the water and saw the judges' scores.
Okay, one where the judges' scores and your feeling of the dive aligned.
Oh, sure. I can do that. So one of the best moments I had as a diver was actually on the heels of a little bit of disappointment. I got better over time, obviously, from being really bad. And I ended up being a state finalist my junior year. And my senior year, I had a bad, I missed my best dive, actually. I had a bad meet. And then I went off to dive in college. And I felt like, okay, you know, I need to do something to, you know, to make up for the horrible performance I had in the biggest meet of my life that I'd been training for almost 4 years. And I remember I was doing a reverse 1.5 straight, which was, it's sort of an unusual dive. You jump off the board forward and you do a backflip and then a back dive. You might also know it as a gainer. And the thing that I did that was unusual about it is instead of curling up into a ball in a tuck position, instead of, you know, folding in half with my legs straight in a pike position, because I still wasn't that flexible, I just did it straight. And so I had to whip my body into this kind of like spinning like I was a ruler. And it was one of my hardest dives. And there was one meet where I felt like I had the rhythm of the board really perfect. You know, you jump up and you raise one knee and then you step down and then you're just waiting to land on the board and swing your arms. And my timing just felt impeccable. And I reached up and I felt like I jumped a little higher than I normally did. I spun a little bit faster than I normally did. And so I had lots of time to prepare for my entry. And I remember grabbing my hands to punch a hole in the water right after I looked back to see the water behind me and just feeling like this is as good as I could ever do this dive. And it might be as good as I could ever do a dive, period. And then as I hit the water, I heard that sound that every diver looks forward to, which is like a sound when your hands puncture a hole in the water and then your hope is that you disappear through it. And it just felt like I did everything right. And I came out of the water and I got my highest scores ever on the dive. And I actually ended up retiring after that year feeling like I'd kind of peaked and I'd gotten as good as I was going to get.
I'm just smiling from ear to ear. So was this your freshman year in college?
It was.
I love it. Okay, so you had, speaking of diving, let's continue with that theme a little bit longer. You had an experience in high school that was formative. It sounds like it was your senior year. maybe your junior year, you can tell us which, where you volunteered to coach two of your competitors. Will you set the stage for us and what happened?
So junior year, I make the state finals, and this was a really big year because I'd also qualified for my first and my second time for the Junior Olympic Nationals. And that made me, I think, one of the top 40 divers in the country. And I was like, this is incredible. I've already exceeded, you know, my expectations of what I'd be able to do after I graduated from high school. And then the summer rolled around and I was training at diving camp, and there were a couple of younger divers who were working on various skills. And the one gift I had as a diver was the entry. You know, for whatever reason, you know, it might be like the shape and size of my hands. It might be, you know, my body alignment. It never actually got to the bottom of this, but I remember one day a coach actually complaining to Eric and saying, you know, well, all Adam can do is rip his entries. Like, all he can do is vanish without a splash. And Eric's like, so? That's the most important thing in diving. but, you know, as a commentary, they're like, well, he doesn't jump very high and, you know, he doesn't spin that fast and his twisting is kind of off axis. Like, all that's good is the entry. And Eric's like, yeah, but that's the biggest driver of the score on a dive. So that was my skill. It was one that, you know, I came in good at, and I got even better at as I practiced it over time. And so there's one diver, Ryan, who was really struggling with his entries. He'd been a gymnast, and so he was kind of the opposite of me. He could jump, he could spin fast, he could twist. He had great air awareness. He was extremely flexible. But in gymnastics, you never land on your head. It's deadly. And so he really struggled with his entries. And I saw him struggling, and I just immediately started to give him some tips. And one of the coaches at camp called me over and said, you know, don't pay attention to other people, focus on your own diving. But I really enjoyed teaching and sharing my knowledge. And I just thought, hey, you know, there's something that I know how to do well that I can help him get better at that'll improve his skills. I'm happy to do it. And so he improved his entries over the course of the summer. And I really didn't see him because he was way across the state until state meet. And he had kept improving. And in part using that beautiful entry that I taught him, he beat me by a couple points at the state championships. Ugh. Still hurts thinking about it.
Well, and what's interesting, and I might be completely wrong, but it seems to me that that experience planted the seeds for this book, this brilliant book called Give and Take.
It might have. I think it kind of did, actually. I definitely didn't know it at the time, but looking back, it was, yeah, Whitney, it was a defining experience in the sense that I didn't want to be in a world where my motivation to help others would be in conflict with my motivation to succeed. I wanted to find a job, a career where I could be ambitious for myself and be ambitious for others, and those goals would actually sometimes align. And I also wanted to know why some people were really motivated to be helpful, and others saw it as irrational or self-sacrificing or stupid.
Yeah, there's a piece of me that wonders, would we have that book if that hadn't happened? Would we have this book?
Are you trying to justify my misery? Is that what's happening right now?
I'm not trying to justify your misery, but I am. In fact, it's interesting that we're having this conversation because I know you've co-authored a book with Sheryl Sandberg. And I remember when she writing a piece that, you know, she wasn't on the board of Facebook for such a long time. And I remember having this thought, would we have gotten Lean In if she had been put on the board of Facebook when she probably should have been? I wondered that. And so now I wonder this, and I'm not trying to make you feel more misery. I'm trying to find meaning in your life. Anyway, it's just a question that came up for me as I was preparing for our conversation. So let's now talk about Give and Take. You've gone to college. You finally decided to major in psychology. You get this PhD in organizational psychology. 2013, you publish Give and Take. Let's talk about styles of reciprocity. The givers, the takers, the matchers. Give us at a very high level for people who aren't familiar with what these are.
Sure. So this will be like any framework for personality or motivation. It'll be a gross oversimplification of how complex this is in the real world. But there is a huge body of evidence that around the world and in every industry that's been studied, there are these three styles of interaction that people adopt. So on one extreme, we have takers, and their primary focus is on trying to figure out what they can get from other people. Givers are the opposite, right? The question is, how can I add value? So they actually enjoy helping other people without strings attached. And then most people don't want to be too generous. They don't want to be too selfish. And so their default is to go into this third mode called matching, where, you know, I will reciprocate whatever you do. So Whitney, I'll do something for you if you do something for me. And I think it's, you know, it's important to recognize that we all have moments of giving, taking, and matching, but we also have a dominant style, right? Which is the way that we prefer to treat the majority of people the majority of the time.
What's yours?
So I don't actually think I'm qualified to judge. I can tell you what motivates me, right? I can tell you that I enjoy helping others and that, you know, I prefer to operate like a giver. Mm-hmm. But if you really want to know what my style is, you also have to gauge whether my action lives up to that motivation, right? So you'd have to ask the people who interact with me how they perceive me and then judge from there.
Interesting. I was going to ask you that question because I look at myself and I think, you know, there are certain contexts where I'm absolutely giver. There are contexts where, you know, we all have our shadow side. I think we all have contexts where we're takers and then matchers. So for everyone who's listening and thinking, you know what, I want to be more of a giver, what suggestions would you make? And then maybe add on to that, if you're a person who wants to create a context where people are more likely to give, and maybe that's a much more complicated question than just what suggestions would you make, but just what are your thoughts?
Sure. So one of the best pieces of advice that I've gotten on how to increase generosity in a way that doesn't seem too daunting or too costly comes from Kat Cole, who runs Cinnabon and a number of other franchises. And what Kat recommended that was really critical early in her career, and she's continued to adopt throughout her life, is that you just go into every interaction asking, how can I be a mini helper? So, you know, you don't have to spend 9 hours helping every person that you meet, right? Or responding to every request that comes in. What you want to do is try to figure out, okay, is there a small way that I can add value? And so when Kat would meet someone new, one of the things she started doing when she was 19 or 20 was to ask, what's the biggest problem that you're facing right now? Or what's your toughest challenge? And then, you know, she would try to come up with a piece of knowledge or a story of something similar that she had faced, or, you know, someone she knew who might be able to help with that. And, you know, it feels like a small thing, but over time, those actions add up. And pretty soon, if you know, a bunch of moments of being a mini helper add up to turn you into kind of a real helper.
That's great advice. Okay.
You also wanted to know how to instill that norm in your organization. Is that right?
I do. You want to answer that one too?
Sure.
Okay.
So I think that there are a lot of things that help on the margin. I think the reality is that people overlook how important help seeking is for creating a culture of help giving. And I think a lot of people shy away from asking for help because they don't want to be takers. But there's a huge difference between taking and receiving, right? We actually don't need takers in the world to have givers. Takers are people who use others. Receivers are people who say, look, you know, I'll accept your contribution with gratitude. And then if I can, I'll pay it back or pay it forward. And we do need people willing to receive in order to have giving exist in the first place. And so I think the problem is that a lot of people don't ask for that reason. You know, they think, oh, every ask is taking, which is not true. They think, I don't want to be a burden to others. You know, I don't want to look incompetent. I prefer to be on the giving end of the exchange. And the problem is that there are lots of people who would be happy to help you if only they knew what you needed. And frankly, who else needed help, right? So the data suggests that 75 to 90% of all helping in organizations starts with a request. So if we want more giving, we need more asking. And my favorite way to make that happen is through an exercise that now has an online version. It's called Give a Toss. Full disclosure, I got invited in as a co-founder, but—
What's it called? Give a Toss?
Give a Toss, G-I-V-I-T-A-S.
Okay.
So it's an online platform for giving and receiving help. And the simple idea is that you bring together a community of people, a team, a network, a whole organization, and anybody who wants can submit a request for something they want or need, but can't get on their own. And then everybody else gets to view that request and then weigh in if they think they might know something or someone that would be helpful. And over time, you start to see this explosion of generosity where, you know, where people realize, oh gosh, there are all these ways that I can help, you know, some of my own colleagues. I just didn't even know they wanted that thing. You know, we've had people fulfill requests to see a Bengal tiger in the wild, to synthesize a strain of the PCS alkaloid, to get a job at Google and discover you didn't want a job at Six Flags. And, you know, very often people are surprised at how much they enjoy helping, at how easy it is to help, and how little they really knew about what the people they thought they knew were trying to accomplish.
And you said you started to answer the question of doing this inside, you know, how do you do this inside of organizations? Have you seen this work inside of an organization where there's this reciprocity ring, I think you initially called it, but now, but have you seen that happen inside of organizations?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the most interesting examples is there's a pharmaceutical company that ran this exercise and somebody said, all right, I'm trying to synthesize this PCS alkaloid. It's going to cost $50,000 US. Can't afford that in my budget. Does anyone know a way to do that cheaper? And one of the colleagues in that room from a different division of the company, they don't even know each other, actually volunteers and says, you know, actually we have Slack capacity in my lab right now. This sounds like a great learning project for my team. I'll do it for free. And saves $50,000 on the spot. And, you know, I think it's kind of a simple form of crowdsourcing where you say, mm-hmm. look, the mistake that most of us make is when we need help, we only go to the people that we've traded favors with in the past or expect to in the future. And, you know, the odds that that person who's helped you before that you know well is the most qualified person to help you with a completely different request are pretty low.
You said you wanted to be a magician and you loved the discipline of performing magic tricks and surprising and delighting people. This sounds like a magician to me.
If your idea of magic is conducting lots of experiments and longitudinal studies and reading tons of research and then trying to pull it all together into some practical ideas, sure.
No, I mean the part where you surprise and delight people by people saying, hey, I'd like to see a Bengal tiger, or hey, I'd like to get this $50,000 funding.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Surprising and delighting people.
That makes more sense. I'm with you now.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So one of the concerns I think that people have is they want to be givers, but they're worried about being doormats. And you talked about a couple of things, sincerity screening and generous tit for tat. Could you explain what those are?
Yeah. So let me put them in a little context first. So when you study successful versus failed givers, you see that it's less about intelligence or competence or talent, and more about the choices they make every day. Failed givers help all the people all the time with all the requests. And so they end up prioritizing other people's needs so far ahead of their own that they either burn out or just plain get burned by takers. What you see with successful givers is they're much more thoughtful about who they help, when they help, and how they help. And so if you break that down, sincerity screening is the idea of saying, look, just because you like to be helpful doesn't mean you should help everybody who asks. What you should do is find out if the person who's seeking help from you has a history or a reputation of selfish behavior. And then if they do, you want to say, maybe this is not the best time to go into extreme giver mode. I should be flexible and adaptable in my style. And maybe when dealing with a taker, I should be a matcher and say, look, you know, I'm happy to help you if you will help somebody else that I'm trying to help. And I think that, you know, at some level, That's the way to go. But there is this little wrinkle, which comes from research by Robert Novak out of the evolutionary biology world, which, you know, starts from the idea that, you know, if you've ever studied game theory, you know that you're supposed to do tit for tat. Because if you start out cooperating and then somebody else cooperates, you want to reciprocate. And so you have two matchers who basically evolve a giving relationship. And then if somebody defects or cheats, then, you know, you should also reciprocate. And then two matchers, you know, become more cautious and they protect themselves. And what Novak shows is that that is true if you have a one-shot game and you don't have to interact with the same people over and over again. But that if relationships and reputations exist, you might actually want to move, instead of pure tit for tat, which is just straight matching, if you're generous, I'll be generous. If you're selfish, I'll be selfish. You want to move into generous tit for tat, which in their models is often, you know, if you screw me over, you know, one out of three times, I will forgive you in the hopes that, you know, maybe it was a misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. Maybe I misjudged you. Maybe you are turning over a new leaf and I want to give you a chance to reset your style.
Interesting. Okay, so that's sincerity screening. We've got the generous tit for tat. Any thoughts on when you're hiring someone, specific suggestions on being able to detect a giver versus a taker? Are there any quick tells that you would suggest or you've seen?
Yeah, I think there's good evidence for a few strategies that are at least, they give you clues. So one is takers tend to take more credit for team successes, and they're more likely to blame other people for their failures. And so, you know, if you find out about somebody's accomplishments or struggles, ask them the extra question, okay, what do you think caused that success? Or, you know, what was the reason for that failure? And see whether they're willing to, you know, admit that they might have done something wrong. And they're willing to credit others graciously. That would be one. Another that I find pretty useful is looking at the expectations that people have of others. So there's a bunch of research suggesting that takers actually anticipate more selfish behavior from others. And that's part of how they rationalize and justify being a taker, right? It's not me. I think all you people are selfish. And so I'm just being smart and cautious. And then a third strategy that I really like is to look at a pattern of kissing up and kicking down.
Hmm.
The idea is that, you know, that everybody engages in some helping behaviors, and takers tend to direct theirs mostly upward because they know that the way you get ahead with powerful people is to help them out and be generous with them. But then they learn, like, gosh, it's a lot of work to pretend to care about everybody. So they let their guard down with peers and subordinates who get to see more of their true colors. And what that means for me is it's often a red flag if somebody has a great reputation upward, but it's more mixed lateral and downward.
You talk about the research says that the smartest negotiators, the more intelligent ones, don't get better deals for themselves, but for their counterparts. Any quick thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's such an interesting finding. Basically, the smarter you are, the more you realize that life is not a zero-sum game, and the more likely you are then to find ways of benefiting others a lot that cost you a little or nothing. And also, the more likely you are to realize, look, you know what? I'm not going to let anyone take advantage of me. And in fact, you know, I believe that by conducting my life in a generous way, that, you know, there are enough matchers in the world that this is not, even if it costs me in this interaction, it's not going to cost me net in life.
Yeah. Okay. So which goes to the next thing that I wanted to raise. You cited research that says that the more people get, the more they give. But as a percentage, it gets less. You said specifically people making less than $25,000 donate 4.2% to charity, and more than $100,000, they donate 2.7%. You then, though, talk about, this is on page 182, you're talking about, in the context of a story that you were telling about John Huntsman, that for every $1 in extra to charitable giving, income is $3.75 higher. Wow. Any thoughts you want to share on that piece of research?
Yeah, so I might have been wrong about the first part. There's a big debate that's just been kicked off by some new research suggesting that, in fact, wealthier people are not less generous.
Oh, good. That's
so
good to hear.
Yeah, I think the jury is out on that one. And okay. I haven't figured out yet where the truth lies. But on the question of what's going on, this is crazy. Arthur Brooks has this evidence that the more you give this year, the wealthier you become next year. And, you know, that kind of doesn't make economic sense. I think that, you know, it is possible that people have high expectations of their future wealth, and then maybe they start giving earlier. But Arthur is convinced that actually what happens is more psychological, that there's a warm glow of giving, that mm-hmm. when you give money away this year, it motivates you. It brings more meaning to your life. You enjoy it. And then you become energized to earn even more so you can give even more away. And, you know, I don't know whether that's true or not, but I think it's a pretty interesting idea to contemplate.
Intuitively, that's what makes sense to me, is that you start to imagine, you know, instead of I want to make X amount of money because I just want more money, you're saying I want more money to put into circulation because my ability to do more good extends beyond where I am. And here's the good that I want to do or I am doing. I think that makes sense intuitively to me from a psychological perspective. Interesting. It'll be interesting to see what the ultimate conclusions are. Okay, so your origin story, as we talked about, the diving story in high school would suggest to me, at least my experience of you, is that you are a giver. And I have certainly been the beneficiary of your giving. You blurbed my book, Disrupt Yourself. So I just wanted to go on the record and say thank you for that.
thank you. I'll try to live up to it.
I was very appreciative. And then the last question that I want to ask you, penultimate question is, is there something that you need right now? Let's do a little give a toss or a reciprocity ring at the moment. Is there something that you are trying to get done that you need that our podcast listeners could be aware of and could possibly help you do?
That's very kind of you to ask, Whitney. I don't know. I think if I had to say there's one thing, I am always looking for new vehicles to share ideas. I guess the easy way to answer that question is to say that I do a monthly newsletter called Granted, which is kind of my excuse for taking the articles and ideas and videos that I found most interesting each month about work in psychology and sharing those with an audience. And one of my favorite things to do is answer interesting reader questions about things they're wondering about in that realm. And so I would say if anybody has a question about worker psychology that they are curious about, I would love to hear what it is. And you can find the info for that at adamgrant.net.
I love the name of your newsletter. That's so clever. Okay. Any last thoughts or advice that you have for our listeners?
My best advice around give and take is to say that, you know, I really believe that the most meaningful way to succeed is to help other people succeed. And I think that the mistake too many people make is they just end up helping other people indiscriminately. And I think that we should all be a little bit more proactive in trying to figure out, okay, where are the places where I make the most distinctive contribution? What are the forms of giving that energize me rather than exhaust me? And then if you focus on those, it's much more likely that you're both helping other people in meaningful ways and also doing that in ways that strengthen you. That to me is probably the best way to think about being a giver.
Adam Grant, thank you for giving your time to be with us.
Thank you for having me.
It will never cease to surprise and delight me at how our early experiences are woven into the choices we make and the lives that we end up leading, like with Adam and his diving experiences. First with his diving coach, Eric. What a gift to work with a coach who has the mindset of looking at a diver's motivation and not their talent level. He said, "I will never cut a diver who wants to be here." Perhaps you have someone on your team who is at the low end of their curve skill-wise, but is motivated to learn and wants to be there. What support can you give? What are you doing to not cut that person? Second, there's the story about Adam coaching his competitor on his entry into the water, though helping ultimately allow that competitor to surpass Adam. I love what he said. "I didn't want to be in a world where my motivation to help others would be in conflict with my motivation to succeed." Live the way you want the world to be. Do you want to be a masher? Do you want to be a taker? Or do you want to be a giver? Practical tip. My first inclination was to call out the suggestion that Adam shared from Kat Cole. Look for ways to be a mini giver. While that is an excellent suggestion, and you can work on that this week if you'd like, I wanted to go with something a bit more challenging. How can you show up as a receiver? As Adam said, in order for there to be giving, we have to be willing to receive. And there are a lot of people who'd be happy to help you if only they knew what you needed. If we want more giving, we need more asking, we need more receiving. So what do you need this week? Be specific, make an ask, be willing to receive. So I'm going to practice right now. I'm going to practice asking right now. You knew this was coming, didn't you? Would you take a moment and leave a written review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you've listened to your podcasts? By doing so, you will be helping guide new disruptors to this corner of the internet. If you've left a review already, thank you. And thank you for continuing to share the episodes and what you're learning on social media. It is kind of you to give, and we are grateful to receive.
Thank you to Adam Grant for being our guest. Thank you to sound engineer Whitney Jobe, manager editor Macy Robison, content contributors Emily Davis and Nancy Wilson, and art director Brandon Jameson. I'm Whitney Johnson, and this is Disrupt Yourself.